What happens when grief doesn't just break you? It dismantles you completely, leaving you to rebuild from scattered pieces you barely recognize. This question pulses at the heart of a story that refuses to offer easy comfort. Our narrator sits in her therapist's office, not metaphorically broken, but viscerally dismembered. Her hands shake when discussing her mother. Her voice fractures at mentions of her father. Her entire posture collapses when remembering her brother. She recites dates and medical terminology with clinical precision, describes funeral arrangements with detached efficiency, analyzing her family dynamics as if discussing strangers. When her therapist pushes her to feel rather than recite, she erupts. "What do you want from me? To cry? To scream? Would that make this more real for you?" The outburst reveals not anger, but terror. Terror of what might happen if she truly allows herself to feel. After weeks of circling this truth, she finally breaks. "It comes like blades, because it's my fault. All of them are my fault. I kill them all. I lose them all." The clonazepam prescription that follows becomes both salvation and prison, creating a chemical barrier between her and her grief, turning days into a blur of half-lived moments. It's only when her estranged sister Viola arrives, commanding her to get up, that she begins the slow journey back, not by rejecting grief, but by finally inhabiting it. Some relationships don't explode. They evaporate slowly, like water left in the sun. She once made him a film about discarded pennies that moved him to tears. He used to leave poetry notes hidden throughout their apartment. Now his texts have dwindled to just K, the barest acknowledgement of her existence. Their physical reconnection in the hallway carries a desperate quality, bodies remembering what minds have forgotten. But when Asher suggests adoption, the fault line cracks open. "I lost a baby too," he declares before storming out, revealing the asymmetry in their grief. She's been consumed by her loss, failing to recognize his parallel journey through darkness. When he doesn't return home one rainy night, her fear reveals the love still burning beneath her numbness. And when she learns she's pregnant again, 6 weeks along from their hallway encounter, her reluctance to tell him speaks volumes. "I'm waiting until telling you doesn't seem like punishment." Their marriage has become a minefield of unspoken words, each navigating around the crater their loss has left behind. Ellis, the baby she miscarried at 16 weeks, isn't just a loss, but a tangible presence. In her dark room, illuminated by red safety light, she shows Viola photographs of Ellis, tiny, perfectly formed hands and feet captured in black and white. "I was a mother," she insists, claiming a parenthood the world often denies to those who lose children before birth. This loss is complicated by an earlier abortion at 22, which Viola helped her through despite disapproving. Experiences presented not as contradictory, but as complex facets of one woman's reproductive journey. When Asher suggests adoption, she resists. Another loss would destroy her. When she discovers she's pregnant again, her reaction is bone-deep terror. For 3 days, she carries this knowledge like a live wire, afraid to speak it into existence. Only when they hear the baby's heartbeat, strong and steady on the monitor, does she allow tentative hope, understanding her heart can hold both grief and joy simultaneously. When Viola appears at the apartment, their reunion crackles with unspoken history. These sisters, once inseparable, sharing clothes and secrets, now move around each other like cautious dancers, afraid to step on old wounds. Viola became the family accountant, the voice of reason, while the protagonist pursued photography with reckless abandon. Viola arrives when the protagonist is at her lowest, unwashed, bedridden, surrounded by takeout containers. Their shared history includes not just their parents' fatal car accident, but also their youngest sister, Maya, who died at 16 from leukemia. Maya was their bridge, the peacemaker who could translate between her sisters' different languages of love. Her absence lives in the negative space between them. In the dark room, when the protagonist shows Viola the photographs of Ellis, something shifts. Viola's acknowledgement, "You were a mother," offers desperately needed validation. Their reconciliation isn't dramatic, but quiet. Viola stroking her sister's hair, the protagonist laying her head in Viola's lap, the way they used to during childhood thunderstorms. They share delivery pizza, picking off mushrooms for each other, laughing at old jokes that need no explanation. The protagonist's documentary work becomes both refuge and confrontation. Her subject, Noah, a shooting victim, mirrors her own trauma. Through the camera, she maintains professional distance from others' pain while unable to do so with her own. Noah was shot while attending her photography class, deepening her guilt. "I kill them all, I lose them all." When they meet by chance after she storms from therapy, their impromptu photography session during Blue Hour, that ethereal twilight between day and night, becomes transformative. Capturing images together in the fading light, something breaks open inside her. Noah's resilience forces her to confront what she's avoided. Survival requires courage, and healing arrives in moments of clarity between darkness. The documentary evolves from professional obligation into healing. The camera transforms from barrier to processing tool, a testament to survival and map for finding wholeness through art. The novel's title refers to that brief period between day and night when the world is bathed in blue light, neither fully illuminated nor completely dark. This liminal time captures the protagonist's suspended state between past and future, despair and hope, death and life. During her photography session with Noah, the blue hour becomes literal space for connection, where familiar landscapes of grief are seen from new angles until different meanings emerge. The concept extends to other threshold spaces: the dark room where images slowly materialize, the therapy office where past and present collide, the hallway where she and Asher briefly reconnect physically while remaining emotionally distant. These in-between places become sites of potential transformation, where becoming takes precedence over being. The novel's recurring reference to Kafka's The Metamorphosis reinforces this theme. Like Gregor Samsa, the protagonist experiences grief as physical metamorphosis, a becoming other that alienates her from her former self. Yet unlike Gregor, whose transformation leads only to death, she gradually integrates her changed self into new life. The pregnancy offers not a return to her pre-loss identity, but the possibility of moving forward as someone permanently altered, yet still capable of hope. "Some losses you don't recover from," the protagonist reflects. "You just learn to build something new around the space they left. Healing doesn't mean leaving grief behind, but learning to live within its blue hour, finding beauty in that suspended time, rather than rushing toward artificial closure. Your losses become part of the architecture of who you are. The question isn't whether you'll carry your grief forward, you will. The question is whether you'll let it crush you or teach you how to hold both sorrow and joy in the same trembling hands."